on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Oh my God, I can't believe it.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Welcome to another edition of
Happiness to be found even in the darkest of times.
That system probably contains a new data encryption algorithm. You'll never get in there.
Yes, welcome to another episode of the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast, the show that talks all things mental health, emotional well-being, and what we can do to make us that little bit happier. Now, off the back of an extremely busy Mental Health Awareness Week, my guest today is an award-winning mental health campaigner, film producer, public speaker, writer, and vlogger. At the age of 20, he was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar. Shortly after the diagnosis, my guest began to make films about his condition that have since gone on and been watched by hundreds of thousands of people. He's tirelessly campaigned and spoke about living with mental illness. He's written articles, books, and given many interviews on TV and radio around the world, all in the hope that it helps stimulate conversation, educate, and break the stigma around our mental health. Recognition came in 2014 when he was awarded an MBE for his services to mental health and suicide prevention. I am genuinely excited to welcome to the show Mr. Johnny Benjamin, MBE. Johnny, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. I know we spoke off air, and I said that, you know, I had a wonderful guest last week, Matt Johnson. It was a pleasure to have him on the show. But what an honour to have you on the show as well. And off the back of, as I said at the top of the introduction there, you know, it was Mental Health Awareness Week last week, and obviously you're a very, very busy man, a very sought after man as well. But a point was made last week, and a few people have said it, you know, yes, it was Mental Health Awareness Week last week, but every week should be Mental Health Awareness Week.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you've got a mental health condition, then every day is, you know, mental health. Well, you're very aware if you've got a long-term condition that, you know, yeah, every day is a mental health day. Do you know what I mean? So, and not just for the individual, but everyone around them as well, you know. I get that, you know, awareness days and weeks are important, of course they are, but yeah, for sure, the conversation has to continue past that one day or that one week. It has to, you know, can't just be that one moment of the year and then that's it.
No, that's it, and we must continue it on. We must continue on these conversations, and we must keep looking to break that stigma and normalize the sort of the conversation about our mental health in line with what we would do with our physical health as well. And that's what's important, and everything you're doing, the show, and everybody else, really. Now, before we get too sidetracked, because it would be very easy to do. Now, Johnny, for the listeners, give us a little bit of background, who you are, what you do, and really what's brought you to this stage.
Yeah, so I guess I kind of started putting myself out there about maybe 6-7 years ago, making films, and I made a BBC documentary on the mental health system in this country, and then I made a documentary on Channel 4, which was essentially it was about trying to find the guy that had stopped me When I was in a really bad place, when I was on the edge of a bridge, he'd come along and he'd talk me off the edge. And yeah, I did a search to find this guy, called it The Stranger on the Bridge. And yeah, went out on Channel 4 in 2015. And then since that day, been, as you say, writing books and giving talks and, you know, trying to hopefully shift some stigma and, you know, raise some awareness and get people talking and just trying to do my bit, really, you know, as much as I can.
And that obviously, that stranger and a fantastic documentary, and obviously there's a book as well, same title as well. And that gentleman, Neil Laybourne, is it?
Yeah.
Obviously a very important part of your life from that moment on.
Yeah.
And if we may, could we? So that was back in that period of difficulty back in 2008.
Yeah, that's was right. Was it? Yeah.
Could we go back there and talk a little bit about that and where you found yourself and what was going through your mind and what life was like for you then?
Yeah. I was in just a horrendous place in my head. I didn't want to live, you know. I've got this diagnosis of this form of like schizophrenia and bipolar, and I was put into a psychiatric hospital, and yeah, I was 20 and just gave up, really, very very kind of quickly on, and I ended up running away from this hospital a month into my stay, and I saw it as the end. There was no other alternative for me. It, you know, in my head back then, I thought the rest of my life was going to be just really unwell and a burden as well, you know, on particularly my parents, and just I just couldn't bear it. I just couldn't bear that thought, which is why I ended up on the edge of this bridge. I ran away from the hospital, ended up on the edge of this bridge. And then this guy, he came along and he had this conversation with me, this kind of half hour conversation where he managed to just, talk me around and convince me that there was another way, that, you know, that life, that life wasn't as bad as I believed it was going to be. There's obviously a really like powerful conversation, and his kindness and his understanding of what I was going through. I hadn't really experienced any interaction like that before, and that's what made me change my mind. This guy and his his belief that I could get better, I think that was the key. No one else had, I didn't believe it, no one else believed it, but he did. So yeah, it just takes that one person, doesn't it, you know, as we say, it takes one person, doesn't it, to change someone's life.
Yeah,
it does.
And do you remember much of the actual conversation itself, the actual content, or was it, or is it the feelings that are so powerful and remain so true for you to this day?
Yeah, do you know what, it's the feelings of being heard, like really really heard, being heard and being not being judged. I think that was really key, actually. I felt really, really judged for, because, you know, I've been in this hospital and I was on what they called suicide watch in this hospital, and I don't know, just any time that I tried to talk about what was going on, I I don't know. I would just, it's like people around me are really scared of me, or scared of my, you know, thoughts, my feelings, particularly the suicidal thoughts and feelings, and they just kept on medicating me. And whereas this guy was just like very, he was okay with me, me feeling suicidal, and I'd never experienced anything like that before, because everyone else had been like, yeah, scared of it, or trying to. They didn't want to, even though I was in this hospital, they didn't want to really talk about it or address the fact that I was in a dark, dark place. It was just like, yeah, just sort of medicate me. That was it. Medicate me and to know. Whereas this guy wanted to address it and not, he wasn't afraid to sort of go there. So yeah, it's the feeling of being truly hurt. Do you know what I mean? Truly hurt.
Yeah.
Really powerful.
Well, I think I have to agree that sense of being heard, that sense of being understood, that sense of being seen is so powerful, is so intense. And I think that when we're in a position of crisis, and we're in this moment of you know, not just in that moment on that bridge, but a period of intense discomfort, it's extremely isolating, immensely isolating. And I think even more so, and listening to you talk there, it is so tragic and sad to hear that even those around you that are meant to be helping paid professionals were not quite getting it as such, and then amplifying that isolation even further.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? And I don't blame them. Do you know what I mean? Well, I don't think it's their fault. I think it's just the training and the education that, like, my psychiatrist was just so focused on medication, and that was it, really. Like, he was kind of obsessed with medication and not trying to really get to the heart of what was going on with me. And then the staff in this mental health ward were just, well, they were very obsessed with safety. They had to keep me, and I get it. But yeah, I just wish someone would have really sat down and, like with this guy on the bridge, you know, like, really being prepared to talk and to listen to me. And but I don't blame them. I think, yeah, a lot of it comes down to like training and education and fear. I think fear, you know, people are scared, aren't they, of suicide? Yeah.
Well, I think they are. I sadly there's I almost feel we have quite a difficult relationship with death,
yeah,
in our culture. In other cultures, it's celebrated. There's a much different relationship they have. And, you know, I agree. I've worked with many people that, you know, suicide for me is the most binary of decisions. It's taking it down to life in its simplest of forms. And, you know, for anyone that I work with, and I believe that, you know, we're all, to a large extent, not broken. It's always the world that's broken, and it's about how do we prevent too much of the world, you know, bleeding into us, if you like, and too much of it will corrupt the system. And so when we feel overwhelmed, when there is too much intensity, when there is too much chaos, the brain craves some form of certainty. And if we sort of distill it down to that binary decision, which gets to that point of life or death, obviously the attractive option is the nothingness that death represents. But ultimately, the energy that we could begin to tailor. And I suppose the conversation with Neil, this comes down to those key constituents or those key components of being heard, taken seriously, understood, respected, seen as a human being. Because, you know, others have heard me say it on the show, what underpins our existence is relationship, and to move from a position of isolation to connection is a wonderful and beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is. And the ironic thing, right, is that, you know, when I was from the moment that I got into this unit, this mental health unit, I was never alone, actually, because I was being watched 24/7 on this suicide ward, which is ironic because I was with someone all the time, but I've never felt so isolated and alienated, if that makes sense, because people would literally just take it in turns to come and do their shifts and watch me. Just used to come in and just take a seat and sit and watch me. And then, when I went to the toilet or, they'd be there. So I was never alone. And yet, never felt more, I would never physically alone, but I've never felt more mentally alone, it's quite ironic, isn't it?
Well, it is. I think that, I think for many people, they can probably empathize with that and connect with that, because so many of us are surrounded by lots and lots of people, whether that be physically or from social media or, from a virtual perspective as well. Yeah. We could sit in a packed Wembley Stadium and feel the loneliest person on the planet. But if we're sitting in there with another person that adds so much value to our life, we're the richest person in the world. And I think that's, I think you paint that picture, particularly well, being on that unit and actually just people coming and going and staff doing the jobs that they're paid for. And there were all these people, but yet there was that lack of connection.
And I mean, I've been an inpatient in several different mental health units, and right the way through till about a year ago. And I mean, for me, it's always been the same, just don't know. It's a weird, you come into a mental health unit at a time of crisis when I am in the depths of despair or whatever. And the time that I need connection the most, and it's usually the time I get it the least, because as you say, people are just really, and again, I feel bad. I'm not trying to, I don't believe it's the, I believe, people want to help, they just don't know how, or maybe they've been too, so like with this guy on the bridge, Neil, he didn't have any training. He didn't know what to say or, what to do, but he just uses human instincts, and I think maybe people's humanity is, broken down or undermined too much. Maybe when they're, I don't know what it is. Maybe when they're training to be a mental health nurse, or they're not all. I mean, there's some amazing mental health nurses. I mean, don't get me wrong. But I just wonder what it is that. I'm with a psychiatrist now that I really got on well with, and she is very sort of human. But I've been with several other psychiatrists who. Don't know, just there's this weird barrier between me and them. Maybe it's in my head, but a lot of it is, like I mentioned with my first psychiatrist, it's just so focused on medication, and you're ill, Johnny, and you've got this illness, and that's what there is to you. Whereas my psychiatrist now is very much like, she doesn't see me as a label. And am I making sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think for me, and my sort of thoughts align quite similar, that there's, for a long time, I think there's been a preoccupation with this symptom-driven approach. So let's just achieve a reduction of symptoms. So whether that be through medication or whether that be through a directive talking therapy that alleviates stress or anxiety. But if we lose ourselves to that quite rigid black and white model, we deprive ourselves of, as you say, the humanity, the humanness, the realness, the genuineness of all of it. And you know, no two individuals are the same. No two presenting crisis are the same. And if we're not able to work in a very organic way, we run the risk of not helping an individual fully, or not being able to reach that individual, because we lose the essence of what we are, and that is human beings. I remember hearing someone, I think actually it was Fern Cotton, said, you know, we're human beings, we're not human doings.
Right.
And I think so often,
yeah,
you know, there's people feel the need to do something. And I'm with you. Look, you know, anyone that works in the helping profession, absolutely, you know, there are some angels out there doing some fantastic, wonderful work. But sometimes that less is more. As you say, what Neil, that conversation on the bridge was, it's what you remember is the feelings, not the conversation. It's how it made you feel. And if we can make someone else feel like that for me is what life is all about.
There's a famous quote, isn't there? I can't remember who said it, but I think the quote is something like, you know, at the end of the day, it's not what people said you'll remember, it's how they made you feel. I'm sure that's a famous quote. I definitely haven't made that up. I've seen it somewhere. And it's true. It's true. Like, it's the way that people, made me feel that I remember throughout my life, most of all through my, you know, relationships have come and gone. It's the feelings, for sure.
So, Johnny, if we can go back to, you know, around sort of that 2008, that period of crisis, and the stays that you've had, have you seen the landscape change? You know, so people that you've worked with, as you mentioned there, the psychiatrist you're working with at the minute, got a great relationship with. Have you seen the profession lean towards more of this humanistic, or do you still feel it's quite black and white?
It's so variable. That's what I find. It's so variable. Depends who you speak to. I mean, my hope is it's, you know, going towards the more sort of human side. But I still hear lots of stories from people who say that, maybe I'm just, I'm really lucky that I've got a psychiatrist that I can be open with. I've got a therapist now that I'm seeing that, again, I feel I've never had a therapist that I can be so like open and honest with, and know I'm not going to be judged. But I also know that I'm really fortunate to have that. And a lot of people I speak to don't have, you know, a psychiatrist, a therapist, a mental health team that are so, I keep on saying like human, but human with them, you know. I think that there's still a way to go. I think there's definitely a way to go, definitely. Yeah, but I like to think that we're moving forwards. Maybe we are.
Well, I think it helps when, you know, like what we're doing, talking about this, and off the back of, as we say, it was Mental Health Awareness Week last week, but it's Mental Health Awareness Week every week. But actually, you know, the campaigns, the conversations that we're having are crucial, I think, to change that landscape. And, you know, something that's come up over the last few weeks and the last few shows is this word authenticity. And for me, a lot of individuals working in a profession, the strength comes from that authenticity, because there's a genuineness that then sort of rings true for you know, people that are seeking help. And I'm pleased that you've got those relationships now with the therapist and the psychiatrist as well. And I would say that it always comes down to, you know, that working relationship. And if it doesn't feel right, then we shouldn't keep sort of headbutting that brick wall. You know, I think anyone sort of, you know, my side of the desk understands that, or should understand that if an individual comes in crisis and it's not quite clicking for them, the professional shouldn't take it personally. It is what it is. And so therefore we've got to kind of work with an individual that we feel the most secure with. And I think that's where the best results will always come from.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, take, you know, outside of the like clinical setting, if you take life outside, yeah, life outside of the clinical space, you know, you think you don't gel with everyone, you don't get on with everyone, and you know, on the outside, I mean, look at all the different, like sort of political views that people have, and like the extremes that people have, yeah. And you can't get on with everyone, and you know, if you can't get on with people on the outside, then you can't get on with everyone, surely, in you know, like a clinical set, and that's fine. It's fine, you know. It's that's life, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it comes down to make that both individuals see that there can't be this imbalance of power, and there never should be, because it's a shared space. That yes, one individual is in a position of crisis, and the other individual should, and hopefully in a position of stability. But there should never be that imbalance that actually, you know, you're coming here because I'm going to fix you. And that's what we were saying off air, that there's this, there shouldn't be this broken fixed model. Actually, it's about this working relationship, this organic process that we, you know, that we tread a path together. And really, from the professional perspective, it's a privilege to be invited into that person's world. So there, it needs to be honored accordingly. And you're right, you know, it's horses for courses, in the sense that we, you know, we have friends, we have work colleagues, we choose places of work because we believe they add value to our life. And when we're seeking help, if we're in a position of crisis, it should always be with someone that we feel will bring and add value to our life during that difficult period. And we must never, ever feel sort of inferior or in debt of the person that we're working with, if you like. You know, if we're in crisis, it's okay.
Yeah, for sure. But the thing is, it's difficult. I mean, I know from my experience, when I've been in crisis, just the very nature of it means that I just have to see the person that I'm sort of given. I don't really have a choice. I'm in crisis. I, you know, same as if you have a heart attack, you go straight to, you know, A&E, and you just, whoever's your doctor you're given, you have to work with them. You have to put your sort of trust in them. It's difficult if you're in that crisis point. Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult. But what I think, once they can try and get you through the initial stage, then you can look at, okay, is this right? Is this, or, you know, that's why, I mean, for me, my family are really important to my sort of like care, particularly when I'm not well. And again, previous psychiatrists haven't really involved my parents, whereas my psychiatrist now is always kind of like, you know, wanting to talk to my, particularly my dad, and, you know, does talk to my dad from time to time, because that it should be collaborative.
Absolutely, it is that collaboration and that support network around is always going to give us the greatest chance to lean against that framework.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Again, I think that's another area that needs to change in sort of terms of mental health, is the involvement of you know, families, loved ones. You know, I think, again, I mean, my dad now, actually, he gives talks himself about, you know, being a dad and having to watch me go through some difficult periods, and how it felt for him, and, you know, his time as a carer for me when I've needed it. So, because, yeah, he said that he never got the help and support he needed either, you know, and that's what I hear too often. People,
yeah, they're often lost voices, aren't they? The family or the carers, the support that, you know, they're, you know, work, you know, seeing their child or their partners in distress.
Yeah,
and that's lovely to hear. Let's go to your first song, and when we come back, we'll be talking more to Johnny Benjamin about his journey, what he's been through, and also about what we can all do to you know, make our lives that little bit happier. So I'm James Rose. This is the Happiness Algorithm. This is my guest Johnny Benjamin's first choice.
Regrets collect like all. precious moments. I can see no way, I can see no way. And all of the ghouls come out to play. And every demon wants his pound of flesh. But I like to keep some things to myself. I like to keep my issues drawn. It's always darkest before the dawn. And I've been a fool and I've been blind. I can never leave the past behind. I can see no way, I can see no way. I'm always dragging that horse around. All of his questions, such a mournful sound. Tonight I'm
Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Rose. My special guest today is Johnny Benjamin MBE. And that was your first song, Johnny. That was Florence and the Machine, Shake It Out. Good song choice.
Yeah, I love that song. It's it's got me through many a difficult period. That song, just the lyrics, I think, you know, which is all about letting go and like, yeah, For me, so something that's, I think something that's helped me in the last sort of few years is getting more like into my kind of body. So through things like running or even dancing, like, I don't know, just, and just like physically shaking things off, physically like letting go. I mean, I'm not saying that doesn't solve all my problems, obviously, but it certainly makes a difference when I'm in a, when my head's just a mess. If like physically I can get back into my body and take my attention out of my head and get into my body and go for a run or do it or dance or whatever, then yeah, it just seems to release some of the like mental tension. It and that's a good song to it's a good song to run to and a good song to dance to. Yeah, love it.
Well, it was going to be one of my questions actually about what, you know, given what you've been through over the years, what is it that you've learned about yourself and what have you been able to acquire on that journey to help manage your sort of emotional well-being and mental health as well, and obviously moving and body and, you know, shaking it out and all that, and running, as you said before. What else have you sort of discovered en route over these years?
I've learned a lot. I've learned that, I think the most important thing that I learned was that, you know, I'm not crazy, I'm not weird, I'm not mad, like all the things I thought I was, or the things that I used, well, okay, I am a bit crazy, but the point is, like, the things I used to say to myself when I was a teenager, when I was in my early 20s, like, I am a mess, my head is a total mess, it's always going to be a mess, I'm worthless, I think all of those things, the negative like self-talk, I still have that negative self-talk, but not like I used to, you know, particularly when I was really unwell, when I got my diagnosis. And I think I think therapy has definitely helped me in the last few years to get out of that mindset, which is that therapy and also talking to other people that, and going to groups and realizing I'm definitely not alone with like my experiences, whether my delusions or paranoia or, you know, some of the things that have gone through my head, I'm not alone, and it makes me human, actually. So yeah, learning more about, I guess, educating myself about mental health and particularly my condition has definitely helped me in the last few years. And talking and mindfulness, and I know mindfulness is talked about a lot. It doesn't obviously work maybe for everyone, you know, but for me, I think it's definitely helped to, again, get some peace of mind, you know, get some peace of mind. I never thought I could find any like peace of mind, any peace and quiet in my head, but you know, I have been able to, which is amazing at times when, you know, I feel like my head is going to explode. And now it's taken a long time, you know, it's not an overnight thing, it's taken a long time it's like training up a muscle at the gym, you know, that's how I think mindfulness is, you know, it's like training your brain. It's, yeah, no different to training your biceps in the gym when you want to build up your body muscle. So yeah, learning all these different kind of, yeah, tools and techniques. And
because I think people, again, going back to sort of some of the interventions historically around sort of medication and reducing those symptoms, I think sometimes people hear or pick up mindfulness and think that it's just instantaneous. They'll, you know, we go back to that doing aspect again. So if I do this, then I'll be okay. But to your point, and absolutely, and just to sort of echo that, it's something we have to invest in, like that muscle, as you say, going to the gym. We've got to keep doing it, and then it you know, returns the dividends, then it provides the rewards. We've got to step away from this society that seeks and searches for instant results or instant gratification. Whereas I think sometimes people say, oh, mindfulness, that'll be good. I'll get myself a coloring book, or I'll do a meditation, and all will be well. But sadly, it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't. And do you know what's helped me actually with that is listening to people that have like used meditation for like, so like monks that have used meditation for, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 years, and that say, well, I still sometimes don't find peace of mind when I'm meditating, and I still sometimes you know, what we call the monkey mind, you know, my mind is jumping about all the time. When you hear a monk say that, that's been meditating for 60 years, and with that honesty, that, you know, I think that's helped me to realize that, you know, everyone's on this, no one's superior, and, you know, everyone's trying to just do the best they can, and with the tools that they've got, and that's okay. Yeah, it's okay.
It is. And that's why I think the openness and the genuineness of people is so important, because then it invites others in, and we've all got this opportunity to learn. And we go back to that superiority, that word superiority. For me, there's no font of all knowledge. There's no superiority. We're all sort of, well, what, there's a lot, I'm hearing this a lot in a minute, a wonderful statement or saying that people are using, that given the current climate that we're all living in, that we're all in the same storm, but in different boats. And I think no truer sentiment could be said, really.
Yeah.
We've just got to, you know, work out, as you say, what we've got at our disposal and how we use it.
Yeah, I like that.
Now, Johnny, obviously what you have learned over the years, do you think things would have been different if you'd have had access to that knowledge or access to the help back sort of, you know, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I had to go on my own sort of journey, as a lot of people do when, you know, they've been given a mental health diagnosis. So like, I always compare it to, my dad was diagnosed with prostate cancer about, well, three years ago now. And when he was diagnosed, there was a kind of clear sort of route for him with treatment. And, you know, it was all, I don't know, it was all sort of laid out from the moment that he got his diagnosis. And there was nothing like that when I got my, and I get it. It's really different, obviously, cancer, you know, it's different. But different, but also I just think that, you know, when I was given my diagnosis, there was no, like, I don't know, there was no guidance at all. I just wish there would have been someone to sort of, and not just for me, but for my family as well, and my friends, you know, just some sort of, instead it was like a massive elephant in the room. Massive elephant in the room for like years. And, you know, again, I'm not blaming anyone for that. It's not my family's fault, my friend's fault that we didn't know how to talk about it. We weren't given the language or the tools or the, do you know what I mean? So yeah, I do. And I, you know, that's why I love doing work with young people, like now, because I can hopefully pass on some of what I've learned to young people that, you know, yeah, are in their teens or, you know, 20s, that going through what I went through. I think that's, yeah, I mean, it's just really valuable. It's really valuable.
Do you remember how you felt when you were given the diagnosis? Can you remember what that felt like?
Well, I remember feeling shame, a lot of shame and embarrassment and guilt. A lot of Well, yeah, a lot of really difficult feelings. And I guess what made it even more difficult was that I wasn't given any sort of, reassurance or kind of hope, or I was just told you're really unwell and that's it. It was scary. I remember being really, scared and confused. And but I think the shame and the embarrassment was the kind of predominant feelings. Mm.
And how has that evolved over time, or has it? You know, are those emotions still present, or do you have a different relationship with that diagnosis now?
It's definitely changed. Otherwise, I wouldn't be probably wouldn't be here talking to you, because I'd be too embarrassed still. So it's definitely changed. But I think now as someone said to me, I can't remember. It was a few years after I got my diagnosis, and I was in a support group, and I said something like, I'm depressed. And this person said to me, well, you know, why do you say that? Like, you know, you'd never say I'm cancerous, would you? That's what this person said to me. And or I'm heart disease. You wouldn't ever, you know, completely associate yourself with, you're more than your diagnosis, essentially. And I was like, oh wow, like, yeah, it's true. I am more than my diagnosis. And I'd never, it was just so interesting. That definitely helped me when this person said that. Because for a long time I was like, I'm this illness, and that's all there is to me, really. And you know, whereas now, I mean, that, you know, I've got this, whatever you want to call it, illness or condition or label, like whatever you want to call it, I've got it. But I've also got lots of other, you know, facets to me as well. That's not the only thing that defines me. So that my relationship with it has definitely changed. It
absolutely. And because I think that's the important part. I worked with a wonderful psychiatrist years ago that said the only way or reason we should ever give diagnosis is if it's going to open doors. And if it doesn't open doors, then we shouldn't be passing that diagnosis. And he said that, and I'm going to do it a disservice now, because the word diagnosis comes from two Latin terms, and it's direction of symptoms or direction of treatment. It's something along those lines. It was many years ago he told me this, but it was really interesting. And that sense that actually, look, you know, this label, this diagnosis that's often given doesn't define the individual by any means. What it does is it characterizes a set of symptoms or behaviors that they're presenting with as a result of crisis. And those behaviors and those symptoms are going to be a result or due to a cause. And this comes back to that treatment, what we spoke about earlier in the show, that if we adopt this symptom driven approach and we just keep looking to reduce symptoms, a bit like a baby's temperature, you can keep bringing the temperature down, but unless you address the cause, it's going to go up again. And so therefore, applying the same principles to some of the crisis that we go through, what we can see is that, you know, and I'm not, you know, medication is a very important part, but alongside talking therapies, alongside sort of specific interventions, we can get, you know, our life to a position that is beneficial and stable and rich and rewarding. And I think that sort of global approach to working in mental health is crucial, and we can't just do this narrow approach. But that's wonderful to see, and such a shame that, as I say, that there was those really sort of potent emotions initially, that shame and embarrassment and guilt there as well. But what you've been able to do, and I suppose this is what I wanted to come on to nicely, is the fact that you have got the charity We Are Beyond that works with children and adolescents in their mental health. Would you share us and tell us a little bit more about the work that you're doing there?
Yeah. So set the charity up Well, you know, so because of the work that I do, you know, giving talks and going into different places, different communities, I just saw that, you know, so many amazing like charities and organizations doing great work, but losing their funding or have lost their funding. I mean, we know about, you know, mental health services and the underfunding of them for, it's been going on too long now. But anyway, so the charity was set up to try and put funding back into those amazing charities and initiatives and projects. Often it's the smaller local charities and projects that, you know, lose out, and therefore it's the, you know, the people in the local community. I mean, so, you know, I live in London, and we know that so much is focused on London, and I get it, you know, obviously it's got a very big population, but I often feel that, you know, London or other, you know, urban places, cities, towns, you know, prioritized over maybe more rural or isolated areas, and that, yeah, that really bothers me. So the charity was formed to, yeah, try and put funding back into more of the maybe harder to reach communities or individuals in more isolated, remote places. So, and yeah, particularly young people, because if we can reach young, as we've been saying, if we can reach young people early on and give them the tools and educate them, you know, it can make such a different outcome for them. So, yeah, it's not easy running a charity. It's certainly not easy. That's been a learning experience, but you know, just trying to do my bit. And you know, always say that if you can just help one person, a few people, then it's worth it. But yeah, it's again, kind of like as we've been saying as well, you know, starting a charity up, it doesn't just happen overnight. And maybe naively, I thought, oh, I'll be able to sort everything out in a year. It's now been 18 months since we set it up, and you know, it's still coming together. So yeah, so it's all a learning curve. Mm. It's all a learning curve.
Absolutely, and obviously alongside that as well, you've got the workshops, the Think Well mental health workshops as well. And is that's a more training aspect for teaching staff and those working with young children?
Yeah, well, it training staff, teachers, and also for young people. So it does go into schools. Actually, we've done quite a lot of work in Essex going into schools, which is great. Yeah, it goes into Think Well goes into schools around the country, and it's great. But I always feel a bit like it's not enough. Well, it's not enough, is it? You just, again, like we're saying about Mental Health Awareness Week, it's not enough just to focus on 1 week out of 52 weeks of the year for mental health. And it's the same with Think Well. It goes into schools, you know, and schools will maybe have something once a year on, or once a term on mental health, and that's not enough. So I think I'm just really impatient, you know. You want change now, don't you? You want, but yeah, but look, yeah, I mean, more and more schools are dealing with it or are willing to address mental health than ever before, so that's really positive. It's positive. Just,
yeah, it is, absolutely. I think we're in a better position than we've been for many a year. But going back to an emotion you touched on earlier, that I still feel that there is a fear attached to mental health and how teachers or teaching staff or anybody in the workplace as well responds to it. And I think that's, you know, I hear frequently people say, well, I don't want to say the wrong thing.
I know.
But sometimes saying nothing at all is worse than saying, you know, because it goes back to the essence of our conversation and everything that I suppose Neil stands for, as you so wonderfully put. There was no special training that Neil had. He was just being a real person talking to another real person in a period of crisis. And, you know, I suppose the one thing that perhaps Neil, well, I'm sure there was fear there, but actually there was, he was managing that fear in that moment with you on that bridge. You know, whereas he could have quite easily allowed the fear to take over and then just carried on walking. And we wouldn't be here having this wonderful conversation now. And perhaps if, you know, people can form a better relationship with fear, because we're all human beings. We all experience anxiety, low mood, fear, worry, distress. And if we can connect with that more and not run from it, I think we'd be better for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100% agree. 100% agree. Yeah.
Well, look, Johnny, let's go to your, this is a nice time to come to this second song choice, because this is a belter of a song as well. I'm James Rose. My special guest is Johnny Benjamin. This is his second song choice. Stay with us. We'll be back after this.
What's the sense in sharing one and only life, ending up just another lost and lonely wife? You count up the years and they will be filled with tears. Love only breaks up to start over again. You'll get the babies but you won't have your man.
Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Rose. That was Candy Staton and Young Hearts Run Free. That was Johnny Benjamin, my guest today's second song choice. Another great song there, Johnny.
Love that song. It's so hard not to get up and start singing and dancing. I was very like, well, I didn't want to scare you, but yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, such a great feel good sort of song, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Another song to run to, or is that for just having a dance in your bedroom too?
That's a bit of a dance, that one. It's just, well, I've got a playlist, like a feel-good playlist that is probably the playlist that I use the most. You know, always just, well, music's the thing that's, you know, I just know that I can just turn it on and I can just... either let go or try and shift my current, you know, state of mind. Doesn't always work, but most of the time it does. I think I used to have a playlist when I was, you know, getting really unwell, when I was really unwell, and it was always, I called it the blues on my iPod, and you know, it was pretty sad music, like sad, depressing songs, all of them. And obviously it didn't help my state of mind, but now I try, and sometimes I still put on my blues when I'm, you know, but most of the time I try and put on my feel good songs, because music's so powerful.
It is very powerful, and I like that, and some great advice there for the listeners, actually, to, you know, with music being such an emotive sort of medium, being able to sort of compile a playlist to lift our mood is something that, yeah, I would definitely endorse as well.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, the great thing about it is I can put it on. You know, if I've come out of a meeting where it's just gone, I feel it's gone really wrong, I can put it on. If I not even in another country and I'm having a, well, whatever, I can put it on. It's there. Music's always there. Do you know what I mean? No matter what else is going on, when things are unsettled or uncertain, music is that. For me, that certainty, it's just always there. So, yeah, music... it's just so powerful.
Well, Johnny, let's talk about sort of you know, your life from, you know, where you were to where you are now, and I suppose obviously we do know you was awarded an MBE in 2017, I think it was, is that right?
A
monumental achievement, an amazing achievement, and one I'm sure you and your family are very proud of. I'm really interested to find out some of the other memorable moments or what you've achieved to date so far and the things that really stand out for you.
I think well, I guess writing a book is quite a big one. That took a long time, and it took a lot of energy, and I poured a lot into that. And then having the book, it was again, you know, naively I kind of thought, oh, I'll get it done in a few months, and it took about two years. And again, I think having it, seeing it in bookshops and having it then translated, was a really big moment. But I was in Lithuania a few months ago, and it just been translated there, and seeing it like in the bookshops, that was pretty, that's pretty huge, you know, it's pretty huge. And then, you know, other things for me, such as running the London Marathon, and doing that with Neil, with the stranger on the bridge.
Yeah.
That's definite highlight. Because firstly, I'd been unwell, and I'd just been in hospital, So I'd come out of hospital. I wasn't sure if I was going to do the marathon, if I was well enough, but I did it and completed it. And that was a huge sense of achievement, massive sense of achievement. And obviously doing it with together with Neil was kind of even bigger, like a moment for both of us, I think. And then I guess, just the work, some of the work that I've done in, I don't know, particularly areas that I'm most passionate about, like prisons or, you know, working in, I did, went to India, a couple of years ago to do some work there in an orphanage in terms of mental health. And that was, and knowing that they then took on what I was saying and, you know, they changed the way that they, were dealing with young people's mental health, the orphans, a lot of them had a lot of trauma. So they'd actually, you know, were changing the way they dealt with that as a result of, you know, well, not just me, but, yeah. I think, yeah, I'm really lucky. There's been a number of sort of, but actually, you know, thinking of it, I think probably the kind of the biggest thing of all for me is dealing with my mental health and, you know, like really dealing with it, like, I mean, you know, if someone would have said to me like 10 years ago, oh, I'd be having weekly therapy, I would have said, nah, you know, I didn't talk. I didn't open up. I definitely wasn't going to talk to a stranger about my mental health. Like the idea of therapy, I couldn't think of anything worse. So yeah, the fact that I finally kind of, I don't know, taking the bull by its horns and try to deal with it, I think is pretty, like, the most important thing for me that I've done.
Well, I think that can definitely be put up there as a major sort of win and success. And I suppose one of the things that often comes to mind that for individuals that are in a similar position to you, that campaign, that are ambassadors, that have that lived experience, that are managing sort of their mental health as well, how do you find managing, you know, obviously I'm gracious and I'm so honored to have you on the show, and I'm very mindful about what we talk about, and, you know, I'm always sort of asking the guests what they're happy to talk about and what they're not, and I hope you don't mind me sharing that you actually said, look, you know, nothing, I'll talk about anything, nothing's off the, you know, off the table, and it's wonderful. But I suppose the bit that comes to mind is, or the question that comes to mind is, you know, when you're talking about it, and, you know, obviously Stranger on the Bridge, a wonderful documentary on Channel 4, and then the book, and, you know, you're reliving all of those emotions again, do you find that you have to separate that out so you're not immersed in that again? Is that the importance of therapy and the right psychiatrist and meditation and running and the playlists?
Yeah, because when I did first, like, start speaking out and talking and, like, you know, sort of exposing myself and, you know, everything I've been through, I was very, like, still emotionally, like, the first talk that I ever gave, I basically cried the whole way through, really, to be honest, because I don't know, I don't think I did have that emotional detachment from it, particularly that moment on the bridge. Yeah, I found it really difficult, but I don't know, at the same time, I felt it was just really important to, I needed to share my story. As a lot of people, you know, a lot of people do when they've been through something that's, you know, traumatic, some sort of illness, and they want to share their story. a lot of the time to help other people, you know? You don't want other people to go through what you went through. I think certainly when it comes to mental illness and, you know, the all those years that I hid it and the shame that it brought, that it caused me. And I think for me as well, I meet a lot of people who unfortunately are bereaved by suicide. And
yeah,
I don't know. I kind of feel I have a bit of a. Well, I have to carry on talking because, you know, so many people unfortunately, you know, aren't here to do it themselves. And if they'd have got the right help and support and understanding, and you know, someone like. Well, you know, the stranger on the bridge, like I did, then I just feel I kind of have a bit of a sort of duty, you know, to particularly around suicide, because I just feel that it's still quite a taboo. It's getting better, but it's still quite a taboo, and you know, still so much. Yeah, just understanding so many people aren't willing to talk about it. So I kind of feel I have a sort of duty to talk about it, even though it can be hard. But yeah, kind of feel I have to. No one's like, you know, forcing me to, but I feel like just drawn to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I suppose you know, you've got that, there is that lived experience, there is that point that you've been to that others are experiencing, and you know, there's an accurate empathy that you can truly offer, and you know, and not to sort of go over old ground that we've spoke about earlier on the show, but with such fear in the world around suicide, it being still a taboo subject, you know, pioneering the conversations in the way that you are and pushing against those boundaries to get people to embrace it and understand it more should alleviate and is alleviating that fear. And I think what you're doing is honorable. I think it's courageous. I admire everything you're doing, as many others do. And you know, we've all got to somehow do our bit. Johnny, well, I mean, the current climate is an interesting one, but certainly, you know, if putting the current pandemic to one side, what does the next sort of 12 to 18 months look like, or what do you want it to look like for you?
Well, so I'm finishing off my next book during this time, actually, which is, well, the next book is focused on hope and recovery and, you know, overcoming. I think my first book was my first book was focused on that as well, but this is, I'm just so passionate about, you know, instilling hope in people. I think hope is just, again, it's such a powerful tool. So finishing off my next book, which I think will be out in 2021, and then, you know, focusing on the charity as well. I really want to try and make the charity a success and try and obviously again help people, of course. You know, also trying to look after my. So it's been a really busy few years, and it's been pretty intense. You know, going around, traveling, giving talks, and writing books, and it's been intense, and I haven't really. I think I've been neglecting for quite a while my mental health. Finally, I think, you know, actually that, well, the this period has forced me to, you know, sit down with myself and, you know, have to deal with, you know, my mental health and try and take care of it, which is a good thing. It's a good thing, but I kind of want to. Even when lockdown ends, I don't want to go back to my old sort of habits of, like, I'm just like rush around, just constantly on the go, so that I kind of don't have to deal with, you know, some internal stuff. But I don't want to do that anymore. I want to, self-development. I want to do more like self-development, you know? Mm. Not just to help myself, but I think to help other people as well. You know, the more that I learn, that I can then that pass that on to other people, be that my family or my friends or like wider community, people that I, you know, I go and give talks all the time. And yeah, if I can, you know, share more knowledge and wisdom, then it's worth it for everyone, I think.
Well, I think this is a, you know, this time has been an interesting one, and it almost has made everyone focus on themselves a little bit more. I would hope anyway, and it's pleasing to hear you say that. I too, the same. And I think that we can all grow and learn from this period and take something going forward and prioritize self a little bit more. And I think everyone is perhaps guilty for not prioritizing themselves as much as they could do sometimes. And so, Johnny, look, before we go, what would be your advice, or what would you recommend to the listeners here on the Happiness Algorithm? What can they do to sort of improve their well-being and bring them that little bit closer to happiness, as it were?
I think being kind. I mean, you know, the theme of Mental Health Awareness Week was this year was kindness. And I think being kinder to other people, but being kinder to yourself, I think that's definitely helped me in terms of my that happiness level. So I'm really interested in like kind of the self compassion model. I read a book a few years ago. It was called Self-Compassion, stop beating yourself up.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting, and I didn't realize how like brutal I was with myself in terms of, you know, the way that I used to talk to myself. And yeah, that really that changed a lot for me, reading that book and then going on to have something called CFT, which is compassion focused therapy. Really powerful. And you know, with the self-kindness, it allows me to, you know, when I'm having those really difficult moments or days or weeks or months or years, to actually just sit with it and be like, that's okay, you know, this is okay, this is you know, it's okay, and I don't need to beat myself up for this. And whereas normally I'd be like, oh, I can't believe you're feeling like this again, like you're such an idiot, just being nicer to myself, and being nicer to myself, kinder to myself, has then allowed me to be kinder to other people and other things around me, the environment and nature, and do you know what I mean? So there's loads of research that's being done on like self-kindness, self-compassion, and it's positive benefits. So I think that's been a game changer for me, the way that I address myself, the way I talk to myself.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's, and I did see a wonderful post from the Mental Health Foundation saying that, you know, kindness starts with ourselves. And that's, you know, and what you say there is so true, because that inner critic can be so aggressive sometimes. That internal voice that we all carry, you know, can really, you know, upset the apple cart and be very, very disruptive. And when you can sit and, as I say, and offer that kindness to self, there's a fairer voice that comes through. And I suppose going back to the mindfulness, it's practice, it's investment in self, where it then builds up that almost that psychological muscle to apply the balance that we deserve. Well, for me, you know, taking from today's show and listening to you speak, Johnny, there's a lot around being heard, not being judged, being understood, you know, recognizing that we all at points in our life will experience feelings around shame or embarrassment and guilt as well. And I think to close in the way that you have is absolutely perfect. You know, the kindness that we then have to overlay that with is what we can take. And looking at it from a specific interventions perspective, if we can, a good old playlist that will get us running or get us dancing around our bedrooms is always going to be a winner.
Honestly, if you haven't created, like, honestly, I mean, create it, but then constantly, like, I'm constantly like, that's the playlist that I'm constantly like looking at, updating, finding new songs to add to. Whereas, you know, like before it was my blues playlist. Like when I was younger, I was like, right, I want more Radiohead. I'm going to find new songs that I'm going to add to that playlist to feel angry to. But now I'm very much like, you know, always trying to find new. And I'm not saying that, you know, that the songs on that playlist aren't all like, I'm trying to think of like a really like, well, basically they're all like the first song that you heard about, Shaking It Out. It's not all about that. The song Shake It Out by Florence and the Machine, you know, in that song, she talks about, you know, I've got a lot going on. I'm stressed. This things are difficult, but there's a way to deal with it. And I think, just look, whatever works for you, finding songs that, finding music or finding other outlets, isn't it? That, you know, you can use to help, if you've come off your path, to get you back onto your path, onto the right track. For me, that's music, 100%.
And I suppose the other thing, like you said, it's trial and error, isn't it? So if something's not working for us, change it. Same with the playlist as well. It's a constant evolving process. Bring new songs in, find new songs, add to it. And I think that's an important message for the listeners, that it's not a one size fits all. We have to evolve and adapt to our needs and the ever-changing landscape, both the internal landscape, our emotional world, and the external landscape, what we're up against.
Absolutely.
Johnny, it's been phenomenal, an absolute honor to have you on the show. I know you are an extremely busy man, and I'm sure the listeners will join me in thanking you for coming on and being a guest on the Happiness Algorithm. The listeners, how can they sort of follow what you're doing? I know obviously you're active on social medias. Could you share your handles and names and stuff?
Yeah, sure. So no, thank you so much for having me. Thank you. I mean, I'm sitting here and firstly, the time has gone so quick talking to you, but also it's gone dark. So I'm sitting here in the dark, but it doesn't matter. Yeah. It doesn't matter because it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me. My kind of just really my name, Mr. Johnny Benjamin, is kind of my social media handle for everything, I think. So just my name, Johnny, Mr. Johnny Benjamin.
And they can catch and they can follow your sort of more the professional platform on johnnybenjamin.co.uk as well. Brilliant. Johnny, thank you so much. We will before I go, we have to hand over to Mr. Hanks to see what Mr. Hanks thinks. Tom, how did today's show go?
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
I would have to agree with that. My guest today was Johnny Benjamin. I've been James Rose. This has been the Happiness Algorithm. We'll be back next week with more great guests, more great music. Be safe, be well, and be happy.
Trees are singing along with me. I'm just looking for happy sunrise lights, my smiley face clock sliding in my socks. I pour my first cup of tea. I'm just looking for happy. If you open your mystery. Looking for happy, looking for happy. Comfort chair, pages where wizards and knights have magical fights as the rain taps so tepidly. I'm just looking for happy. In the sand, your head on my shoulder, drinking the moment the sun falls into the sea. I'm just looking for happy. Yeah, I'm just looking for happy.
Phoenix FM.